You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Cameron Carey. I'm the Anne and Andrew Tisch Distinguished Visiting Fellow here at Brookings Institution in the Governance Studies Program. I want to welcome all of you this morning to this discussion about the e-privacy regulation in the EU. I encourage everybody to tweet at the hashtag that's up there on the screen, but please be sure to silence your cell phones. We will have questions at the end of this, so keep those in mind, and when we do get to the questioning, I ask you to stand up and identify yourselves, and we'll have somebody with a microphone. So many people have heard about the general data protection regulation in the EU, particularly with recent events. There's been a lot of awareness that Europe has this new broad privacy regulation coming into effect May 25th. There's been much less attention. It's operated a little bit under the radar on the e-privacy regulation, which was intended originally to take effect, to be done in time to take effect May 25, but it's taken a little longer. Has been a little bit under the radar. So we have the right person here to talk about that in Birgit Zippel. She is a member of Parliament in the European Union since 2009, coming from Germany, the Rhine-Westphalia region. She is a member of the Social Democratic Party in Germany and of the Socialists and Democrats group in the European Parliament, where she is a leader of that group within the Libe Committee that oversees particularly data protection issues. It's sort of the equivalent, roughly, of being a ranking member. And in particular, she is the rapporteur, the manager for the Libe Committee for the e-privacy regulation, and is taking that docket into the process of negotiations with the European Council. So with that, let me turn to Birgit Zippel and ask you to set the stage a little bit. So I mentioned there is a general data protection regulation taking effect. It's comprehensive, covers all sectors in pretty comprehensive detail. So why an e-privacy regulation? Why is there a need for a special law to address electronic communications?
Okay, thanks for that question. First of all, thanks for inviting me and having this opportunity to talk to and maybe with a lot of people here in the United States. During the IAPP conference, I got aware that, of course, the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, has got a lot of awareness because there are a lot of detailed rules within that legislative file. And also, of course, the interest here in the United States is big and also in other areas, as we decided that that regulation should apply to everybody doing business and services in the EU or for people staying in the EU. So a lot of work, I could imagine, already has been done to clarify what can we do to apply to that rules. So why in addition, an e-privacy regulation. We had some debates in European Union if it wouldn't be had been a good idea to have both the data protection and, in addition, the e-privacy, trying to do it within one legislative file. But the history of both files is we have different legislative files, so we are continuing this process. And the reason why we have the e-privacy regulation is that, coming from European Union, for us, privacy and data protection, they are fundamental rights. In addition to some rules, how to process data, what can you do, what can you not do with all the different kind of data, the question of protecting privacy, your private life, is something where you have to get some more attention, some stricter rules how to ensure that we stop this, like I personally call it, digging into my privacy as digging into a gold field without any respect for my personality and private life. So that's why we started to work on this e-privacy regulation that will apply, same like the data protection regulation, to all companies offering goods and services to people within the EU. So it was foreseen to be a very easy legislation, just complementing the data protection regulation, but it came out that there is now a big fight, that this is the evil legislative thing. But I believe to some extent that is because people were not very aware about the rules that already exist. And I will only start, before we go into the debate, with one example. Many people do not understand why suddenly we give so much importance to the principle of consent. Hey. But the truth is, at least for the European area, because so far it's a directive, a law only within the EU. So the directive already says, since 2009, if you want to track people, you do need prior consent. So it's not a new rule, but to be honest, very often it has not been completely respected. And of course, those who never respected the rule in the past don't want to respect it now, but we decided that we need to be more strict on that now. So a lot of debate is around that question. And by the way, of course, consent is good, but it's not there in all areas. And consent, of course, coming back to the general data protection regulation, everything that is illegal according to the general data protection regulation will continue to be illegal even if you ask for consent, because you can't give consent to something that is illegal.
Yeah.
Okay, so far.
So, yeah, but I'm still puzzled because the general data protection regulation, I mean, you talked about digging into privacy, my privacy, to tracking. The general data protection regulation has provisions dealing with profiling, with additional consent required for profiling, and a number of provisions affecting marketing. So what's different? What's the added problem that you're trying to address?
Okay, with the general data protection regulation, we are talking about data you might have gotten from different areas by different means. With the e-privacy regulation, we precisely talk about communication. So all communication data, if it's emails, SMS, WhatsApp, Skype, so whenever there is a communication, that communication needs to be very strictly confidential, protected. So it's not the data themselves, but the communication that needs to be respected. And in European Union, so far, with the current directive. We have protected emails. We have protected SMS messages. But everything that popped up after the old current directive, so-called over-the-top services like WhatsApp Messenger, Skype, and other things, those forms of communications are not protected because they haven't been there when we decided the old directive. So for us, it's very clear, communication needs to be confidential and protected. And there shouldn't be a difference if you send very old-fashioned. I do not know if anybody is still doing it. If you send a letter, a paper letter, into an envelope, give it to the post, send it. That letter, of course, should be confidential. If I send you a letter, only you should read it, and nobody in between. So the same thing should go for phone calls, for messengers, and everything else. So that's the additional thing more precisely to everything that's in communication.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about metadata, because certainly in the analogy that you've talked about, the contents of the envelope are sealed, but you know, the Postal Service and potentially other people can see, and in some cases need to see, the address information on the front, and at least have the potential to see the return address if it's on the envelope. The equivalent in the electronic communications is metadata, the addressing information, call, detail records in the case of phone companies, email addresses, or URLs in the case of other online communications. How does the regulation treat those?
Now, first of all, we are not only talking about letters, and the equivalent would be an SMS or an email. And, of course, you need to know where the communication starts and where it should end. But here the first point is the Postal Service needs to know where should I send this letter, but the Postal Service shouldn't give that information. Oh, here I have a letter from Birgit to Carrie. How often are they exchanging letter? I should look upon it. Postal Service shouldn't do that. They just send the letter and then forgot about the data. Same should be for others. In addition, we are talking about communication via the Internet. You are not only phoning maybe a company to order, old-fashioned example, a book. You go to an Internet page and say, hey, I would like to buy a book. And the problem is that, yes, of course, the service provider needs to know your name, your address, maybe your credit card, so that you can do the paying for the book. But is that service provider allowed to take that data and link it to other information they get of you? Or are they allowed to sell that data to others? So inform other companies, hey, Birgit Zippel has bought 10 books. Maybe she's interested because the books are all about how to prepare your garden better. So she might be interested in a winter garden or in a pavilion, something like that. So they are selling the data to someone giving other services. No. If they want to do that, they have to get my permission. So you see, a lot of things are going around. Some metadata are needed for a special service, but if you want to do more, you need consent, as long as it's not illegal.
So you know, I want to explore how some of that data can be used, because there is beneficial potential. So take your analogy. You send a letter to me. I think we probably all agree that you know, keeping track of how many times that you are communicating with me and how many times that takes place is problematic. But the Postal Service may have an interest in knowing how many letters it's delivering to the United States as opposed to other places for purposes of its planning. And when it comes to metadata, there's a lot of potentially socially useful information. So I did a paper here at Brookings about 3 years ago on the use of data for social good. I was actually co-author of the paper. Lead author was a Belgian who was a graduate student I worked with at MIT, who's one of the leading scholars on what you can learn from metadata, and is the person who flagged that you could take what's supposedly anonymous telephone call records, and with just 4 points in time and space, be able to identify one person uniquely. So there's certainly are privacy issues that raises, but what we were examining in the paper was that there are uses of that metadata that can be socially important. I mean, it's been used for disease tracking. So we were looking at sort of these scenarios for using records for social good, for humanitarian purposes, and the challenges of doing that while protecting privacy. But, you know, also some of the regulatory challenges. And, in fact, as we were working on this paper and the Ebola crisis happened, and there were efforts to try to use telephone call records to help track migrations of population help look at potential sort of pathways for migration of disease. Can you do that under the privacy regulation? How does it impact the ability of communication service providers to share their data for purposes like that? Because I think those concerns about doing that were part of the things that inhibited the use of that data in the Ebola crisis.
Okay, I will start with the first example to start with the easy thing. Postal services might need to know how many letters are going to and from the United States, how many letters do come into Washington or are leaving Washington. But for that purpose, you do not need to know who is writing letter to whom. You need to count the total number of letters, and then you need enough staff to distribute them into the town, that's true. But you don't need exactly who is writing a letter to whom, so that's no problem. Interesting enough, we always get these examples. There are very good things you can do with data. And the problem today is that collecting different data, you can use them in very different ways. Mm-hmm. And we see today with only in last days, it's not the only example, and it's, to be honest, not very new. To some extent, we had some knowledge. It could be done that way with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. So you can use those data in your example, maybe, to deal better with health crises. But you also could use the very same data for discrimination, to stop all kind of migration. So that's why the purpose needs to be described very precise. You need to find out whose data are you collecting. And for those who are preparing the good thing in the health area, do they have the individual data? Is it necessary to know that Birgit Zippel might have a disease problem for the purpose you are working on? So these are all the questions where we say, if it refers to an individual, then you have to be very, very careful, and then it depends, is there an overall public interest? We are talking about legitimate interest. Mm-hmm. We are very critical on that, not to broaden that too much. But we do need, in any single case, have that definition. Is there an overall public interest in that knowledge? And how can we then do it while minimizing the risk for the individual to totally give up his or her privacy.
So let's follow up a little bit on legitimate interest. You said that you've been critical of that, and that's certainly been one of the controversial areas for those who aren't into the arcane eye of European data protection. The data protection regulation allows data processing on the basis of legitimate interest of the company that's doing the processing or that holds the data, provided that they balance that interest against the protection of rights of the data subject, the person that the data is about. And it's my understanding that, as the Parliament has reported the legislation, that's not allowed under the e-privacy regulation. Do I have that right?
No. Coming back to your example of the health risk, to be honest, that's not precisely maybe done under e-privacy, but under GDPR, where we have some rules. If a hospital doctors have some information and it's necessary to deal with it for the purpose you mentioned, maybe they can use it in an anonymized way, maybe, for such purposes, but that's data protection. And in e-privacy, we are not talking only about health data, we are talking about communication. I'm communicating with the hospital, me communicating with the doctor, me communicating maybe with an internet page to get some advice. And that communication needs to be protected. I don't want to be my health data in the hands of my employer, for example. Maybe I don't even want that data coming from that communication to be given to family members. I don't like that for different reasons. So that communication needs to be protected. That's e-privacy. If the hospital still has the data and there is an overall interest to say, oh, suddenly there is a disease risk and it's growing, we have to find out why, then we are in the area of data protection regulation. So that's not e-privacy. So we have to be very careful in which area we are just in.
But let's try to keep it in the context of e-privacy. So take our Postal Service example. I think what I was saying about using the address information for business planning, isn't that an example of legitimate interest? So to put it back in the context of e-privacy, does it allow, my understanding is it would not allow for processing based on legitimate interest.
I wonder why we are going into such details, and I wonder how have postal services in the past been able to do their service without doing all that investigating in private data and privacy data. They were able because they had the overall information. We do get a lot of letters coming to Washington, and then they could do it. So we have to be very careful if we are talking about examples that might look nice, but maybe do not have that big additional value that really you could consider for that purpose, I need to give up my privacy. So to that extent, once again, when talking about privacy and my private communication, that's a fundamental right. And you can't balance fundamental rights against some business interest, commercial interest. You can't say, oh, the commercial interest is bigger than the fundamental right. Sometimes you have to find practical solutions. That's true. But you can't balance a fundamental right. A fundamental right is a fundamental right.
Doesn't GDPR do that on legitimate interest, where it says balance the legitimate interest with the rights of the data subject?
Not to the individual. We are talking about general data regulation. So once again, coming back to your example, if in a special area doctors or hospitals get aware that suddenly many people do suffer from cancer or something like that, then there is, of course, a good reason trying to find out could there be a special reason why this is happening? Mm-hmm. So you have to do some research. But that research mustn't be on the basis of individuals. If you are doing it on the basis of the individual, trying to find out where are those persons who suddenly suffer from that disease, where are they working, what are they doing, what is happening in their gardens, many things can happen, then you have to contact that person, but then you do need their consent. Could we please work for that? You know, we have a problem in that area, we need to find out. So first you need consent, and second, you need to make sure that these information are really only used to find out what is going on in that health area, and you can't give that information to other services doing other things or to other commercial interests.
Mm-hmm. So the other area that I understand has been particularly controversial, or you know, the subject of certainly lobbying and debate, is the impact of the e-privacy regulation on advertising, okay, and on electronic communications in media, and particularly online media. Can you talk a little bit about how this regulation affects that area, and when your thinking behind that?
Yeah. That's a big issue also in Europe for the press, for the media, saying with that regulation, that's the end of all of our media services online. And why do they believe that? First of all, there are different things that happened and that can't be solved or better regulated only by e-privacy. The first thing is, when we started with all these nice digital services, starting with things like Facebook, Amazon, we thought, oh, that's great things, we can do it. Downstreaming films is another thing, without any cost. Instead of going to a shop, asking for a film, paying money, hey, we can downstream it without any costs. But what we forgot in the very beginning, because we all more or less were fascinated of these new possibilities, what we forgot is it's nice that you can downstream, that you get information for free, that someone has to do the work. And the work needs to be paid for. So how we are organizing that? And we saw that there are some developments regarding getting films and music for free. Now we organize some services that you can do it via a platform, but you have to pay some amount of money. So with the media, we have a general problem. Even before we started with all these digital newspapers online, many media, at least in Germany and in Europe, I can talk about the situation in Europe, they already had some problems. And media pluralism already had been under threat before for very different reasons, because many people thought, I don't need a newspaper anymore, I can look the TV, I can listen to the radio, why should I pay for a newspaper? So that started long before, and then with the internet, some press media decided, oh, we go also to the internet, but how do we organize it? We make it for free, but, and that's what's taking place today, and very often, without the readers really knowing about it, you will be tracked. So there will be a platform, and the magazine, the press will say, oh, we are following our readers, and we are not only looking how often do you read my newspaper, but they will follow you all over the internet. Oh, what are my readers doing? Which internet pages do they visit? How often? How long? What are they doing? And all these information, they create profiles, and they sell it to whomever is interested. And I'm convinced many people do not know that this is happening. And this is the praxis, I already said it, since 2009, to some extent is illegal, has been illegal. No one really cared about. That might be also a political problem that we did not push enough. But now with GDPR, it's not only e-privacy. With GDPR, we say if you want to track, you need to ask for consent, and the consent has to be specific, freely given, and informed. And just saying, oh, I track you, that's nothing. Who is tracking me? For what purpose? It's not specific. It's not informed. So it's already no longer possible under GDPR. It's not the e-privacy. And the problems for the media to get the money for their work to do, to finance journalism, I'm sorry, that problem can't be solved by data protection. And maybe they need to find new ways either to... And we already see they try to start to get money for the newspaper, for single articles, maybe even some newspapers, but that's on them to decide, are creating a platform altogether so that people are ready to pay a special amount for two or three newspapers and read some of the articles. So I agree, for the media there are some problems, but the problem started before. But the problem with consent does exist even without e-privacy, because once again, consent needs to be freely given, informed, and specific. But that's already in the GDPR.
Should we pay for media? What's your vision of how the media survives in this online world, where there's many sources of content, and some of the traditional sources of advertising have gone away. I mean, here in the U.S., we have Craigslist has wiped out the classified advertising sections of newspapers.
Now, first of all, once again, everything we use in the internet, at the end, going into the detail, there is some work in the end. If it's a journalist, if it's someone producing things, if it's someone writing a book, doing some music, there is someone really working, and those people need to be paid. Sometimes I'm asked, hey, you want the media that we have to pay for their work if it's in the internet? That's not good, because everybody has a right to information, even if they are poor people. I don't understand that argument, because I can't remember any time in the past where information was for free. You always had to pay for a newspaper. And it's true, sometimes poor people, workers, organized their own newspapers, but not because of the money, but because they wanted to have different information. So information never has been for free. And I think the argument that it has to be for free is simply because people want to make business with the data, and we are not only talking about creating a newspaper. And by the way, if you ask how could it be done, to be honest, I'm a little bit old-fashioned. I like, when being home, to have my printed newspaper, especially on the weekend. Take some time, have the paper in the hand, look around, read the one article, read it again, that's fine. But I'm not always at home. As a member of European Parliament, I have to stay in Brussels, I have to stay in Strasbourg. And the digital version of my newspaper, I can read it also here in Washington. So I'm paying a special amount for getting my printed newspaper every morning at my home in Germany. I'm paying an additional amount of money to get regularly this digital version of my newspaper. I also pay a special amount of money for a weekly journal that I have in Germany, so I'm ready to pay. You might say other people do not have the money to pay two or three newspapers, but that has nothing to do with e-privacy. Maybe we have to think about the wages that we pay to our people. If you don't have enough money to even pay for one newspaper, the problem is not in e-privacy, then the problem is in the wages that we pay.
So let's talk a little bit about the model and how that gets affected here. So paying for information, you get a digital subscription, that gets you past a paywall. It's okay to have a paywall. is it okay to have a tracking wall? It says, you can't have access to our information, I mean, to our content, unless you agree to basically allow us to serve ads.
Now, the question is, what does it mean? Do you allow me to track you? Once again, does the newspaper tell me, I would like to know how often you are reading our newspaper, I would like to know which articles are you especially interested in, and then I can think about, okay, that's my newspaper, do I trust them? And it's good that they try to find out in which areas they should deliver more articles because I'm interested in. But that's not what they really do. So the other question is, will they ask me? And once again, already under GDPR, consent needs to be specific. You have to ask, oh, yes, we want to, we as the newspaper want to follow you to improve our service. Do you agree with that? But we also want to sell your profile with everything you are doing in the internet to others. Do you also agree to that? And I could imagine not everybody would agree to that, for good reason. And the fact that people so far are not protesting simply might be that not everybody really is aware of what is going on. And so we are simply willing to give back people a little bit of a control about their private life. Mm-hmm. And we also have to keep in mind, if you say we are doing it, everybody can be tracked, you sell that information, so you have a tracking wall, you need to do that. We could also talk about fake news. What does it mean? If you depend for your newspaper on many clicks, so that you can say to the advertising sector, hey, a million people are following me, so better you give me the money than to another newspaper, because the other newspapers, only 100,000 people are following them. So what does it mean? What will you do to get that many clicks? Will you really work on good journalism, investigative journalism? Or will you say, oh, we also have to work on other things to get all the clicks so that somebody from the commercial area will give me the money? We have to think about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's turn to all of you for questions. Does anybody? Yes, sir. Fast with your hand. Do we have a microphone coming up here?
My name is Axel Spies. I'm here with Morgan Lewis here in Washington. I want to bring in another issue that's a hot button.
Microphone's coming. Although you have a very booming voice.
And that's the Cloud Act. You may have heard that last week as part of the omnibus budget on page 2,200, there is a Cloud Act in there that basically invalidates the Supreme Court's case right now against Microsoft allowing access to personal data in Europe, stored in Europe, through U.S. Warrants in case that there is such a scenario. And the only way to get around that is that you can demand a hearing by a judge, but only if you are a qualifying foreign government, and I don't know what that is already. Why isn't the EU Parliament all up in arms about that? I think that's a big violation of Article 48 of the GDPR and others, but I don't hear a lot from the EU Parliament on that.
Yeah. Before you answer that, I do want to correct aspects of the question, because a U.S. provider can also object if the warrant is for the data of a non-U.S. person or if it believes that the request would violate foreign law. Go ahead, please.
Okay, first of all, I think we hope that this Cloud Act will never come. So we had it on the radar, but now it's there last week. And it's true it has been debated sometime here in the U.S. But this week I had some debates with representatives from the U.S., and not everybody here is really aware what it practically means. From the side of the European Parliament, you might know that we supported Microsoft in the Microsoft case, where we already talked about the question, is it really necessary or legal or important that they give away data that are stored in European Union? And we clearly supported Microsoft in their position to say the data are in Europe, most of the data maybe are from European citizens or people staying in Europe, so there's no US jurisdiction. We don't want to give away the data. Now with the Cloud Act, we already contacted our commission to say we have to check what this means in practical terms. Because once again, with the Microsoft case, we clearly said, no, that's again our rules. We don't want to give away data. So we are right now starting the process to check into the details.
Next question. Yes. Right there. Yeah.
Hi, Eric Wanger from Cisco.
Stand, please, just
a sure.
See you as
so
well.
I'm just curious about, I want to push a little further on this idea of consent, because you said you cannot consent to things that are illegal, and if something's not permitted under the GDPR, then you cannot consent to it. And yet, and this may be a difference between U.S. law and the law in the EU, but consent actually here does define in some ways the things that are permitted and are not permitted. So if Cam were to come up to me and hit me, he could be criminally prosecuted for that. But if beforehand I were to say to him, please hit me, then he would not be prosecuted for that because it would be within the bounds of my consent. And so I believe that you agree that that the reason that things are provided for free is that in exchange for that there is some value that's being derived from the tracking of the behavior. And I certainly get the idea that the consent has to be specific, informed, and
freely given.
If those things are true and people do understand, because I think it is a fair question whether or not people understand the actual extent of the tracking and therefore the value that they are exchanging, but if they really do understand specifically what tracking will take place in exchange for it, is there a role for the government to decide that certain types of tracking are beyond the scope of what people should be able to consent to? Is it a question of people understanding, or are there things that people can't actually agree to?
Okay. So first of all, coming back to that link between GDPR and e-privacy, everything that is illegal under GDPR is illegal and cannot be consented, nor under GDPR, nor under e-privacy. But what we did, knowing that these digital worlds are a little bit different to our old analog world, is that the proposal broadens the possibilities to process metadata and also consent data. But it's very often difficult to decide if it's really a good idea to process that meta or even content data. And that's why we said, but if you want to use these broadened possibilities for processing data, in that areas where we allow it, you need to ask for consent. So it may be that I agree. It's a good idea that you follow me through the town because I think if you use that data to find out if we can improve, I don't know, the walking ways, because I'm very often walking, but in that town there are only streets for cars, no ways for walkways, so you could check with that. Or any other thing. Maybe I like to be profiled because you give me good advice which dresses I should buy next year because they are very in and whatever. If you like to do so, you can consent. So many things stay illegal. Many things might be used from your personal data, but then you have to ask for consent. And then, coming back what you already pointed out, that consent needs to be very specific. So you have to explain to the individual user, what are you doing, why are you doing it, what will you do with the data, what is the purpose, and then the user has to say, okay, with that information, I agree that for that purpose, you can use that data.
So let me ask a follow-up to that question, because it, in some sense, it sort of brings me back to where we started the discussion, as to, you know, why this on top of the GDPR. If tracking, if consent is required for tracking, and tracking is already illegal under the regulation and under the directive, why this legislation? I mean, you've described it as an expression of your hope to, as I think you said, abolish surveillance-driven advertising. If that's what this is about, why is it necessary on top of GDPR if it's already illegal?
Okay, it's already illegal under the e-privacy directive. So, secondly, so far, that's the European Union thing, how to do legislation. With the directive, you create a minimum level of rules, but every single member state can add something. You can't lower the level that you give, but you can add something, you can improve, you can offer your citizens a higher level. So far we had directives, so very different levels of protection. That's one reason why now we are doing regulation, because a regulation is a regulation and you have to use it like it is in all the 28 member states. That's one reason. The second reason is that, as I said at the beginning, not all forms of communication were protected, because we made the mistake to talk about precise things like emails, SMS, but technologies have evolved. So we forgot about other services, and that's another reason why we have to work on e-privacy to create one rules. And the other is that when talking about tracking, maybe at the very beginning we thought the old-fashioned idea, my newspaper will follow me and it's only my newspaper looking into my data, but now we know it's something else. The whole world maybe will follow me because my data are sold, all the information to the whole world. And that's something where we say that's not possible. And it was not in the proposal from the Commission in e-privacy, but clearly the Parliament says, okay, if there is a service offered, you can't have this tracking wall. So you agree that all your data are collected and are sold to whoever is ready to pay. So we want to have a ban on the tracking wall. And the reason is that we say the access to a service, and the analogy would be going into a shop, going to a ticket shop to buy a ticket for the train or for a museum, something like that. Going to that areas and using that service couldn't mean that you exempt surveillance measures. If I go into the shop or a ticket counter, it's not necessary that first I tell them, oh, you know, my name is Birgit Zeppel, I'm living in Germany. Last time I visited the following 10 web pages. I like flowers. In my garden I do have tomatoes and blah, 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 blah. I don't need to give that information simply to enter a shop or enter a ticket counter to buy a ticket. But in the internet, that is happening right now, and we want to stop that.
Yes, in the back, on the left. Just take on the aisle, and then, right here on the aisle.
Good morning. I'm from India. My name is Diya Basu. I'm a PhD candidate at American University here. My question is to find out how much collaboration there is between EU at bilateral or multilateral forums in informing data protection regulations of other countries, and I'm particularly interested in India because it's currently in the process of framing its own data protection regulations. Thank you.
Shall we take the other question?
Yes, why don't we take the other? Good idea. Mm-hmm.
My name is Roger Cochetti. I work with private equity in the technology sector. And my question has to do with a broader aspect of all this you haven't discussed too much, and that is surveillance and enforcement mechanisms. As I think anybody who's dealt with this subject knows, a great deal of this is going to come down to the specifics of enforcement. Using the metaphor a few minutes ago, if someone were to ask, may I touch you? And I say, sure, and then you punch me. did I give consent? That's a form of touching. And if I ask the question in Flemish and you respond in Greek, have I given you specific consent to touching when you're punching? So enforcement is going to be 99% of this. And could you discuss a little bit of how you will actually surveil the agreements that are incurred between service providers and individuals, and how you would then enforce your regulation once you've surveilled the text or the terms of these agreements in multiple languages? Thank you.
Okay.
So India and supervision and enforcement. Okay.
The first question on how do we connect with others to inform them, having in mind that those rules shall apply to everybody offering services to people in the EU. Now, the first thing is that within Europe, we are informing all the member states, of course, because they are involved in the process. Then we have a lot of international contacts via our different committees in Parliament. The Commission has their own contacts to inform everybody about the new rules. And I think there is a networking inside Brussels, for example, between the Commission and the different embassies that are there on international level. And also many NGOs are very active, data protection activists, and we have a European data protection officer. We have all the other European data protection officers. They are linked to partners all over the world. And I think India is a very good example for the time being about the good effects of GDPR, because we were just informed that some time ago India decided that, yes, data protection privacy is a fundamental right, and you are starting that. And so I hope you and other people from India were able to take part this week in the IAPP conference to get more knowledge. But, of course, you also should follow the detailed information from the Commission, because we not only create the law, but the Commission and all our data protection officers are giving additional advice how to deal with the different parts, and if you contact them, that's fine. The question on how to follow and ensure that the rules are implemented with that clear question on touching or doing something else. Now, first of all, that's why asking for consent, you have to be very precise. That's one thing. In general terms, we want to have, we strengthened the role of data protection officers, also demanding impact assessments whenever you are doing it. And we are strengthening our national supervisory authorities so that they can control if all the actors are ready to do it. In addition, you are completely right. If you ask in Dutch and you answer in Greek, there might be a problem. And how do you control? So first of all, you need to ensure that your user does understand what you say. So if you are coming from Greece, you offer a service to Germany, of course, you should offer that Germany also in German language. Otherwise, no one would use your service. That's the one thing. Then the question of control. Did I really consent to what you did in your example? So whatever, in whatever form you ensure, the moment I give consent, you as the service provider, the service, you have to ensure that you always can prove I gave consent. If I do it by writing a letter, yes, now I do consent to that. Or if I do it via an email, or you organize it in a way that's a technical question, that I put it in the internet page, But the question and my answer will be electronically stored so that you can prove on the 1st of January, here I can show you, you gave consent. But every company needs to find their ways. They can ask for consent, but then they have to prove if, when, and for what purpose I really gave consent. So if there is a conflict, there is also a proof for that.
So one question to wrap it up, because we're coming to the end of our time. Yesterday at the Privacy Professionals Conference, you described yourself as a chief negotiator for the Parliament with nothing to negotiate because the European Council hasn't formulated a position yet. So looking ahead, what do you expect from the Council, both in terms of timing and in terms of substance, and Will this be done before the mandate of the Parliament runs out next year?
Now, first of all, saying I have nothing to negotiate, that's the official situation, because officially negotiations between Commission, Parliament and Council as a representative of our member states can only start after the Parliament has done its job. The member states also have a position. But, of course, unofficially, I do try to get information from different member states, from the Council, how far they have done things. But that's, let's say, under the radar. It's informal meetings that we are doing. Official meetings, now, member states announced that maybe they have a position on the 8th of June. So, let's see. For me, it's a little bit late, because originally the idea was that GDPR and e-privacy should apply at the very same time. But okay, member states need some more time. So now 8th of June is in their calendar. I wouldn't be sure it will be the date, but in case it is, then after the 8th of June we can start the official negotiations. And if you now would like to ask me how long that negotiations might take before we have an agreement, that clearly depends on the very precise position that the Council is coming up with.
In terms of positions, what do you expect the issues to be?
I will not be very precise, but it's without any question that the position of the Council will differ from the position of the Parliament. So, but I hope with some goodwill from the Council and from our side, of course, we could have a decision at least this year. And I also hope that after the allegations regarding Facebook and Cambridge Analytica within the Council, there is now more awareness that data protection and protecting privacy is not only something, oh, it's nice to have it, but it's really something important, and that hopefully will affect their position on e-privacy in a positive way.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sure more people will be watching the process as you move forward.
Okay, thank you.